Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, the history of fighting guerrilla wars, of counterinsurgency, could make a strong nation weep. Julius Caesar groaned at the trouble mighty Rome had with insurgents. Lyndon Johnson despaired in Vietnam. Our guest tonight, Peter Maas of the New York Times Magazine, has drawn an intimate portrait of one of America's leading authorities on counterinsurgency, now fighting in Iraq. The story of one man, U.S. Army Major John Nagle, and what he and the U.S. military are learning in the Sunni Triangle tonight on Point, counterinsurgency, street by street in Iraq. We begin in southeastern Iraq, where tensions are still running high after 2 days of clashes between Iraqi police, British troops, and protesters that left six Iraqi protesters dead and more wounded. Stephen Farrell is correspondent for the London Times. I asked him what happened in Amara over the weekend.
Well, what appears to have happened is that an unemployment riot or demonstration turned nasty on Saturday and led to a situation in which Iraqi police opened fire on a crowd of protesters, shot dead, it seems, five, and then British soldiers who came in to reinforce them later themselves opened fire and killed another one protester. The violence continued the next day on Sunday at a much lower scale and gradually trickled out over Sunday night and into Monday. The apparent cause of the protests was dissatisfaction over the sharing of jobs that were being made available by the coalition provisional authority, the ruling administration in Iraq. But the authorities do say that they believe there were political activists and Baathists involved in stirring up the trouble.
Steve, we've been told that the South has been fairly peaceful, the areas under British control fairly docile even. This doesn't look docile, a riot that turns into so much death.
Well, the South is a very large place with a lot of differences of geography and culture. And now Amara, the place where this happened, is a particularly tense in some ways town. Although there hasn't been much trouble there, there's been stuff bubbling away under the surface. It was a town that effectively liberated itself under Saddam. It didn't wait for US or British troops to do it. It was a Shia majority town that just evicted the Baathist regime, and as such it sort of feels that it is semi-independent in a way, and there has been a hangover from that ever since. There is also a very large proportion of Marsh Arabs in that area, and there are definitely prickly relations between them and other non-Marsh Arab inhabitants of that area. There are also a Baathist element. There is also a downright criminal element. So you have a hodgepodge of different clashing elements all together in one town. Generally across the South, you have to say it is more quiet than up north. Certainly attacks on coalition soldiers are a fraction of what they are in Baghdad and the Sunni Triangle to the north. But that doesn't mean to say that there are no issues there and there's no discontent there. Effectively, you have a Shia majority population, the vast majority in the South, who are extremely happy to be rid of Saddam. That doesn't mean to say they're happy with having effectively, as they see it, a crusader presence, the Christian occupation army. It doesn't mean to say they're happy about the lack of jobs and about the continuing hijacks, looting, and thefts that you do see on the roads down there. But they are prepared to give the coalition greater leeway and more time to get things in order than has been the case up north, so far at least.
Have you talked with the British troops in Amara, Steve? How did they interpret what happened on Saturday and Sunday, and what are they looking at in the days and weeks ahead?
I did talk to them because we got caught up in the riot, and I myself got stoned, and the rioters tried to kidnap my photographer, and we sped out of the place at high speed with stones flying in through our windows. From there, we spoke to the Iraqi police, and they had one analysis, and then we spoke to the British Army after that, and they had a fairly similar analysis, which was that what started off as a genuine jobs protest was disrupted by, they don't know how many, but let's say dozens for argument's sake, of people who were clearly spoiling for trouble and had prepared flash grenades and guns and hiding behind the generality of the protesters who were throwing stones. Suddenly you got these guns being let off and then the flash grenades fired, and both the Iraqi police and the British say they had no choice but to open fire into the crowd on the Saturday because their own lives were under threat. And I spoke to enough people down there. It does seem like that was the case, although coalition sources did say to me that they felt that the police had acted in a very macho and provocative way and actually had to be pulled out because they felt they were an inflammatory factor.
We read that there may have been tribal differences between some of the police and demonstrators. Did you have any word of that?
Yes. The whole underlying issue here appears to be that there is a faction which controls the local town hall, and they have been accused of doling out jobs for the boys. The jobs have been hoarded, if you like, so the perception of the crowd goes, by the most powerful tribe, the Abu Muhammad, and the town officials who are part of that tribe. Many of the police, I was told by officials I trust, said that the police outside the town hall were on the same tribe as those inside the town hall. So although this is a broad generalization, you can say that there was a certain element of defending our own people and perhaps doing so in a very aggressive way. That said, there was unquestionably a very, very nasty, hostile element in that crowd, and the police felt their lives under threat, and the British Army certainly felt their lives under threat and opened fire.
Do the British and Iraqi authorities in Amara then think that they have the resources to bring more jobs on stream quickly enough to avoid this kind of violent, deadly confrontation in the future?
Well, I think you can broaden this out across the south and indeed all of Iraq. What you have is a society that has been hugely dependent under Saddam, government jobs, security forces, army, police, towards 500,000. And there's going to be nothing like that in any new armed forces that the coalition provisional authority sets up in Iraq. So are they going to bring on jobs enough to satisfy everybody quickly enough? I very much suspect not. I spent yesterday in the domino halls and the pool rooms and the cafes of Basra, and people were saying, young and old alike, there are not enough jobs. We are engineers having to do menial work because there's nothing around to suit our qualifications. Some were advocating patience. Others were saying, no, you know, they've had 9 months now. They should have made a better fist of getting the country running. It's just a question of when will patience run out.
Tough times in Amara. Steve Farrell, we're glad you made it out of the riot. Hale and hearty, thanks for joining us.
No trouble.
Stephen Farrell is a Middle East correspondent for the London Times. He spoke with us from Kuwait City. History's lessons show that successful counterinsurgency campaigns require time, patience, and luck. The U.S. counterinsurgency effort underway in Iraq looks to be no different. Downed helicopters and continuing attacks on U.S. forces and Iraqi civilians make tough headlines. The situation on the ground for Iraqis and U.S. forces is tougher than the headlines. Our guest tonight, Peter Maas, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, has profiled the effort of one man, U.S. Army Major John Nagel, a counterinsurgency scholar and now a battlefront officer in America's slow, messy, deadly struggle in Iraq. Tonight on Point, the story of Major John Nagel and his war, the country's war in Iraq. Can you imagine what U.S. troops are up against in the alleyways and checkpoints of Iraq? From your perspective, in America, can you tell if U.S. forces are winning, losing, or treading water? And will the U.S. stay the course if the course is long, hard, and messy? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Peter Maas, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and author of Professor Nagel's War, the cover story in this week's issue. Good evening and welcome, Peter Maas.
Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. What a story you tell here, and what a profile you found to do in John Nagel. Tell us about this man. This is not just any soldier on patrol in Iraq.
Not at all. He's somewhat of an unusual soldier at that. He graduated nearly at the top of his class at West Point, number 23 in a class of about 1,000. He then was selected as a Rhodes Scholar. He then returned to active duty, led a tank platoon during the first Gulf War, earned a Bronze Star for his efforts. I talked to some of the soldiers who served under him then and said he was brilliant. He then returned to Oxford to get a PhD, and he decided to focus that PhD and his thesis on counterinsurgency, which at the time, and this is the mid-late 1990s, mm-hmm. very few people were paying attention to. And when he finished his thesis, it was good enough. It was published as a book in 2002.
So when you decided to profile Major Nagle, what were you looking to do, Peter? What were you looking to illustrate?
I was looking at trying to see the war through the eyes of somebody who knew what he was up against, who had studied what he was up against, and then see if he was able to apply the tremendous number of lessons of history in order to make this effort, this counterinsurgency effort in Iraq, a success rather than, as most counterinsurgency efforts of all time, not just in the last century but well before that, rather than a failure, which is the tendency of counterinsurgency efforts.
We want to dig in to what John Nagle's bringing to his view of Iraq tonight, but first tell us where he sits tonight, or you know where he's posted now. He's in the thick of it. What exactly is John Nagle doing in Iraq today?
His battalion is based just outside of Qaldiyah, which is in the Sunni Triangle. It's like halfway between Fallujah and Ramadi. Fallujah and Ramadi, of course, being you know the some of the worst towns in the Sunni Triangle. Qaldiyah, also one of the worst towns in the Sunni Triangle. Nagle's base is actually at a former Iraqi airbase. He lives in a little room right in the Tactical Operations Center. He's got, ironically, a portrait of Saddam Hussein above his bed, and then some other kind of humorous Doonesbury-like cartoons above his desk. And basically, he spends his life either in the Tactical Operations Center or out in the field conducting the raids that he's responsible for planning.
And it's no joke, he's lost colleagues there.
Six soldiers in his battalion have been killed so far. More than 40 have been injured. And this is a battalion that has 800 soldiers. So he knows every single one of them, and it's a serious casualty rate.
And that doesn't even begin to describe the Iraqi allies who also have faced their own threat. Peter Maas, take us now, if you would, into John Nagle's kind of toolkit. What did he come to Iraq with in terms of all this study of counterinsurgency, guerrilla war, how to counter it, what the lessons of other great powers fighting insurgencies? Give us a little taste of what's in his intellectual backpack as he headed to Iraq.
Well, his book focuses on the lessons learned from Vietnam, which was obviously an American experience, and Malaya, which was a British experience during the 1950s. Malaya was actually... It's viewed as somewhat of a successful counterinsurgency experience, whereas, of course, Vietnam was not. And particularly from the Vietnam example, Nagle takes away from it really three main lessons. One, that the use of indiscriminate firepower, which was used in Vietnam, is a recipe only for disaster. Secondly, that when you're faced with an unconventional threat, which is what an insurgency is, you have to use unconventional methods. You can't use conventional methods such as widespread bombing and expect to also meet an enemy that's massed in the field against you. But then also, and this perhaps is almost the most important lesson, you have to wage a vigorous and successful hearts and minds campaign, not just because it's the right thing to do, but actually because it's a strategic necessity. You're fighting really not just the men with the guns, but you're fighting for the support of the people without the guns, and you need that to win.
And Nagle took this away not just from the conflicts in Vietnam and Malaya, now Malaysia, but from even his larger study of insurgency and counterinsurgency going all the way back to the Romans.
Absolutely. There's no shortage of literature about counterinsurgency through the ages, and Nagle has studied it. Unfortunately, not as many people have and certainly need to. There's even very recent experiences that America has had in counterinsurgency. El Salvador is a very good example of that. And that's a war where actually there's a kind of doctrine that was developed for it, or that was attempted to be used there, called total war, which sounds a bit like scorched earth policy, and perhaps some of of total war is scorched earth. But really what it means is that you can't just win militarily. You have to also win politically and economically.
Peter Musk, we're going to hear a lot of detail of what Major Nagel is facing now. But overall, he came into this zone. He wasn't part of the invasion. He came in for the occupation. He came in with this huge wealth of knowledge behind him, perhaps bigger than anyone else out there. What has been his response to seeing insurgency and counterinsurgency firsthand in Iraq?
He told me that what I mentioned to him in one of our first meetings, that you know, he's an expert at counterinsurgency, he just laughed. And he said, you know, that just kills me, because I thought I was an expert at counterinsurgency until I actually got here and tried to do it, and now I realize how little I know.
We're going to come back and look at the lessons of history and the lessons that Army Major John Nagel is learning every day in Iraq. My guest is Peter Moss, author of a new article in the New York Times Magazine, Professor Nagel's War. You can join our conversation tonight from your seat in the United States. Can you tell if the U.S. is winning, losing, or treading water in Iraq? Can you imagine what U.S. troops are up against in the alleyways and marketplaces there? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American counterinsurgency challenge in Iraq. My guest tonight is Peter Moss, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. His new article there is Professor Nagel's War. It profiles a U.S. Army major, John Nagel, a deeply tutored scholar in counterinsurgency, now facing the reality of counterinsurgency in Iraq, and it's a tough reality. You can join our conversation tonight. Is the U.S. taking the lessons of T.E. Lawrence, of Julius Caesar, of Vietnam, to Iraq, and how does it sound to walk in the boots of Major John Nagel and his troops in the Sunni Triangle? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Does the United States have the stomach to go the long, bloody distance in Iraq? Peter, give us a sense of what it's like day in and day out for this scholar and his troops on the front line, if we can call it front lines. I guess the battlefront is kind of everywhere in Chaldea.
It's difficult from the moment that he wakes up and opens his eyes. Even when things are going in his direction, they're not easy to accomplish. A simple example that he gave me is when, for example, an informant comes up to the gate with information about somebody who's a bad guy shooting mortars at the base, mm-hmm. and Nagel talks to these people, and then they do get a fair number of people coming to them with that kind of information. These folks, they can't give them the address of where the bad guy lives, because in Iraqi villages, there are no addresses. There are no street names for the most part. There are no numbers in the houses, and the houses all look alike. The informants are also reluctant to get into an American Humvee to point out the bad guy's house, because they don't want their neighbors to see them in a Humvee. And the Iraqis also, to a great extent, are unable to read maps or overhead satellite imagery, because they're just not familiar with maps. Iraq having been a very totalitarian, repressed country, actually, there wasn't a great circulation of accurate maps, and people never learned those skills.
You're right about Major Nagel saying, well, I could take this this informer or I don't know how you want to describe it, put him in the back of a Mercedes, you know, wear local garb myself, kind of crouch down and idle by the house. But then I'm out of bounds from Geneva Convention military, military order. And he himself wouldn't be a proper combatant if captured or killed.
Right. He would lose, if he takes off his uniform, certain protections under the Geneva Conventions. That, of course, however, is why there is the special forces. They're the people who are trained to go around in local clothes and who accept the risks that involves. The problem for Nagel is that there are not enough special forces in Iraq. And so he doesn't have a team of special forces who are just kind of waiting in the tactical operations center for the nod from him to go out and take an informant to a neighborhood. He has to wait around for the special forces to show up, and that might take a little while. And in that period, the intelligence that he's got from the informant might become stale. So even when things are going in his direction and getting good intelligence is absolutely key, actually doing something about it, and this is where theory going into practice becomes quite difficult, that's a major task and not easy to fulfill.
You write about Major Nagel entitling his book, looking at the counterinsurgency lessons in Malay and Vietnam. He entitled it Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, and there he's quoting T.E. Lawrence of Arabia. What's the reference?
The reference is to T. E. Lawrence's book, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which he wrote, T. E. Lawrence, of course, being popularly known as Lawrence of Arabia, which he wrote about his involvement in leading Arabs who were revolting against Ottoman rulers during World War I. And the book is priceless and sells quite well even today because it's an insider's view of insurgency as well as being a literary classic. And there's a passage in there where T. E. Lawrence describes the difficulty that the Turks had in trying to combat his rebels. And T.E. Lawrence said, you know, war upon rebellion for the Turks was messy and slow, like trying to eat soup with a knife. So Naglo used that as the subtitle of his book.
And now he says he was in the first Gulf War. He won a Bronze Star. But that, as you quote him, was easy. You said, we shot the tanks that didn't look like ours. We shot the enemy wearing a uniform that didn't look like ours. We destroyed the enemy in 100 hours. What is John Nagle's assessment of how long, how difficult this counterinsurgency war may be?
His assessment is that they're making progress. He thinks they're going to win. It's a three steps forward, two steps back process. But most kind of notably and realistically, he believes it's going to be very long. That he's smart enough to not give, you know, time frame, saying, oh, it's going to be a year, two, three, four, five, or 10. But he just says, look, this is going to be very long, very slow, and it's going to be very messy. And what messy means is that there will be civilians who are killed who shouldn't be killed, civilians arrested who shouldn't be arrested, and there will be Americans killed who, of course, one doesn't want to see killed.
Peter Maas, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, Stephen Metz. He's chairman of the Regional Strategy and Planning Department in the U.S. Army War College's Strategic Studies Institute. He's author of Insurgency and Counterinsurgency in Iraq in the winter issue of the Washington Quarterly. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Metz.
Hi, great to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you. Stephen Metz, you have written that there is a real danger, at least at the time you wrote this for the Washington Quarterly, that there's a real danger of Washington underestimating the challenge of dealing with the insurgency in Iraq. How do you see that today?
I really think that since the time I wrote that our policymakers have taken a hard look at it and have a pretty good understanding of the extent of the insurgency today. To be quite honest with you, I first wrote that in August when there still was I think some misunderstanding of the extent and depth of it. But I think that between August and today, our policymakers, our strategists have got a pretty good understanding of what's going on there.
And what's the evidence of that in the changed thinking in presence and deployment on the ground?
I think that we can certainly see evidence of the changed focus in terms of the statements from our top policymakers. I think we can see evidence of it from the deployments that are taking place, the switch that's taking place in Iraq today. We can certainly see
this, evidence. This is the big turnover of sort of 100,000 in, 100,000 out.
We can even see evidence of it in terms of the sort of long-term planning that's taking place. In other words, there's preparation going on in places like the Army's Training and Doctrine Command that's not only thinking in terms of the handover that's going to take place in the next few months, but how might U.S. forces be better at counterinsurgency in years henceforth. So I think that there really has been a tremendous focus of effort on not just counterinsurgency, but on stability operations in general, which would include counterinsurgency.
And yet you write that the U.S. has taken on a really fearsome challenge here. You say the idea that open government is a universal model has long served as the essence of U.S. foreign policy. For better or for worse, Iraq has been chosen as the place to prove this point. How difficult is this going to be, Stephen Metz?
Oh, I think it's going to be extraordinarily difficult. This is a part of the world where the idea of open government has never taken hold before. I think Iraq is probably the best place in the region to undertake this great bold experiment, simply because it is a place with a great history of learning. It's a place that really has long been one of the most advanced parts of the world, but it's also a part of the region that's coming out of 3 decades of darkness. So it's going to be extraordinarily difficult, and I think it's going to be a multi-generational task.
And when you read Major Nagle's comments and saw his portrayal that Peter Maas has given us in the New York Times on Sunday, what was your response? Here's a very, very well-informed American military man in messiness that's up to his knees, up to his hips, that's deep.
Right. Oh, I, yeah, I thought it was an absolutely outstanding portrayal. One thing that did come to my mind there, and one of sort of the shortcomings of Americans when we get into this kind of war, is the absence of the cultural element. I mean, you know, we use the example of Malaya, the British in Malaya, mm-hmm. as an example of a successful counterinsurgency. One advantage the British had, though, is they had been in Malaya for literally decades at that time, so they understood the culture, they understood the people. We've gone into Iraq without that kind of cultural experience. So even though we have, you know, brilliant people like Major Nagel who understand counterinsurgency in sort of a theoretical sense, what we really don't have is the deep understanding of the culture of Iraq. And that's what has really put us kind of at a disadvantage.
And one wonders what happens when 100,000 or more new troops come in to take the place of those who are going out, presumably, Peter Moss, taking some of their new learning with them.
Well, that was one of the problems, actually, in Vietnam. There's a famous kind of saying about Vietnam. It's that we weren't there for 17 years. We were there for 1 year 17 times, which means that troops were rotated out more or less, you know, after a year, and the knowledge that they accumulated after a year was not entirely lost, but certainly people who replaced them had to learn it anew. And that is one of the problems. I asked Major Nagel about that, based on the British experience, because the British troops, they had been there before, the civilian administrators and the troops stayed there for years. And I said to him, isn't that the way that it should be done? And he kind of said, well, yeah, in an ideal world, that is the way it should be done. The troops who come here should stay here for several years. But he said, you know, look, we have an all-volunteer army, and we just can't do that.
Let's invite our callers into this conversation. There are a lot of them who want to join. David's calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. One of the last places that was chosen to prove a U.S. point by using a counterinsurgency warfare you mentioned earlier was El Salvador. Mm-hmm. You may remember that that war basically came to an end after U.S.-trained ATLA-CAP battalion troops carved the brains out of four Jesuit priests. Mm-hmm. And that you may also remember that the front-page coverage that U.S. Special Forces troops were caught in the Sheraton Hotel there in a crossfire as they were trying to get out of the country after having given what was called human rights training to the ATLA-CAP battalion. Mm. These special forces in Iraq are going to engage in the same kind of human rights abuses that special forces troops have engaged in all over the world. They're going to use whatever they believe is necessary. They're authorized to use whatever is necessary, and they're going to violate human rights. They're currently violating human rights.
You think they will be sucked down into off-the-charts human rights violations?
You know they will. History shows they will. It's happened in every instance. This will not be an exception. The difference here may be the media, which I consider to be largely a lapdog media, and a whole lot of praising these boys, who you must remember are individuals legally with their own, they must make their own judgments. Some of these young men need to understand that they're going to be called over to commit human rights violations against civilians in a total warfare scheme, as your callers have, your guests have talked about.
Yeah, David, we've got the picture, and there's no question that that kind of risk is there. You know that and describe it in El Salvador. Peter Moss knows that. And Peter, John Nagel knows that. He studied this, and you write about how he says this danger of using too much firepower, too much death and destruction is always there, is a real pitfall in any kind of effort like this.
I talked to one commander there about interrogations of detainees and the tactics that they use. And although nobody wants to talk specifically about those, none of the commanders there or the interrogators, you know, he said to me, look, in these interrogation rooms, we're not singing Kumbaya. They are shouting. They are intimidating, I believe, and people have confirmed that to me. But that's a little bit different from what, for example, the Salvadoran army was doing, quite a bit different. They were killing people in the interrogation rooms before they even got to the interrogation rooms, and killing civilians absolutely intentionally. And so I think the issue that the caller brings attention to of human rights abuses, the greatest danger in Iraq, I think, is less from the U.S. Soldiers, although, you know, you need to, of course, be sure that they're abiding by what they should be abiding by, but the local forces that they're in the process of training and whom they hope to hand over counterinsurgency responsibilities to. It's the local forces that very often aren't well-trained and that do not have the same culture and discipline that, let's say, a Western army has. And they're the ones, particularly in El Salvador, they were the ones who were really committing the hideous human rights abuses. And that's something that's going to have to be watched out for.
And yet, you do write about John Nagel observing the sort of the midnight raids and the damage that goes on when the vehicles and troops go across gardens and through doors and through homes. They are taken of necessity by counterinsurgency into domestic situations where there are a lot of people who are women or children or uninvolved.
Exactly. It's a paradox of counterinsurgency. On the one hand, you need to attack your enemy. On the other hand, you also need to not alienate people you're trying to get the support of. And so when you're attacking your enemy, it's almost inevitable that you're going to be knocking down doors of innocent people, you're going to be detaining innocent people, and you're occasionally going to shoot innocent people. And it's almost could be an impossible task to do what you need to do to capture and kill the enemy and to do what you need to do in order to get the support of the population. And that's where they run into these serious problems of alienating people when they're out on raids, because they're indeed using force, sometimes lethal force, and sometimes not directed at the right people.
Stephen Mitz, what's the risk of the wrong balance being there, and as our caller David points out, of the whole thing spiraling down into really unacceptable violence if it goes forward, if it's long, if it's messy, if the U.S. obviously increasingly wants to hand it over to local allies, if they remain allies, how big a risk factor do you see this being?
Well, I think Peter really hit the nail on the head, in that I think however long it lasts, I have full confidence in the discipline of American forces to resist human rights abuses. But the greater the role that the new Iraqi security forces play, the greater the risk there is of that.
You have that confidence in U.S. forces because it's a volunteer army, because of new training? I mean, Vietnam, things got pretty unwieldy.
Well, but we really do have a totally different military now in terms of training, in terms of education, in terms of discipline, in terms of morale, in terms, you know, a lot of different ways. But the problem with the new Iraqi security forces is that there's simply not a history, a tradition, a culture of respect for human rights, respect for civil rights, and things like that. As Peter pointed out, dirtiness is one of the aspects of insurgency. One thing I was thinking about, and, you know, I mean, David did raise a very, very good point, but I think one thing that we need to keep in mind from a larger perspective, though, is that ultimately, at the very end of the war in El Salvador, despite all the horrific abuses, El Salvador ended up with a lot better system than it started with. So ultimately, the counterinsurgency in El Salvador did generate a better system than it had at the start.
Well, but nobody wants to be party to that kind of violence. Albert's calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Albert. You're on the air.
Yeah, there's going to be risk all the way around, and the longer we're there, the better human intelligence we have. You know, yes, this could be a very long and bloody war, but it's going to have to be fought. This is the war on terrorism. If you don't fight it there, it's going to come back to haunt us if you don't fight it. I mean, we didn't fight it in the 90s, and it certainly came back to haunt us on 9/11.
And do you have the sense, Albert, that the United States is prepared for the long haul, even if it's bloody and messy and the casualties keep coming?
We don't have an option. If we want to win this war on terrorism, we don't have that option anymore.
Albert, thanks for your call. Peter Moss, how about that? Did John Nagel see any option, or is he on the same page as Albert, that this is the way it has to be?
When he told me that he thinks that they're winning the war and that they can win the war, this was premised on the assumption that the U.S. military would continue to get the resources and public support and political support that it needs, and that it will continue to get it for as long as the war carries on, which in all likelihood is going to be for years. That's something that's beyond Nagel's control, and that's why very often in insurgencies, actually the insurgents are really trying to get at most, not just the soldiers in front of them, but the public behind the soldiers back home in America, to try to diminish morale and support for the effort, so that the occupying power is driven out not by the military action on the ground, but by political decisions back home.
Peter Moss, Stephen Mitz, stand by. We're talking about the American counterinsurgency challenge in Iraq tonight. Listeners, you can join us. Is the U.S. taking the lessons of T.E. Lawrence, of Julius Caesar, of Vietnam to Iraq? How does it sound to walk in the boots of Major John Nagel? Does his assessment of the war in Iraq now lead you to hope or to look for the exit? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American counterinsurgency challenge in Iraq. There was invasion. There is occupation. There is an insurgency, and it is a tough one, a diverse one. The U.S. is up against it here. So far, hanging in, what do you think? What's your assessment of how the counterinsurgency is going, and does the United States have the stomach to go the long, bloody distance in Iraq? Should it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, Peter Maas, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, and Stephen Metz, chairman of the Regional Strategy and Planning Department at the U.S. Army War College's Strategic Studies Institute. We're joined right now by caller Morgan from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Morgan. You're on the air.
Hi. I was in Iraq, in the southern part of Iraq, from May to December on a...
So you're just home.
On a medical mission with an NGO.
Mm-hmm.
And when the British came in there in May, they had 40,000 men. They went around and pretty much turned over the country back to the Shias because there was no fighting, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
They thought they accomplished their goal by basically Iraqicizing the whole thing. And the truth is, the Shias are arming themselves. They're bringing in people from Iran daily in big trucks. I mean, I've seen this personally. I'm no military guy, so, you know, I'm not going to claim that I know what's going on there.
And where do you think that's headed, Morgan?
Well, they're arming themselves. They are arming themselves for the getting rid of Saddam as their their mandate from Allah to take their country back.
So do you see them then as joining the insurgency against coalition forces or ready to fight for autonomy, for independence? How do they factor in?
Well, just listening to the people. Now, I only talked to real people here. I didn't talk to any leaders. But what I saw and what I heard was this, that they already have control of one-third of their country already, and they're not going to give it back. They don't accept us on any level. They don't believe we belong there. And they're willing to negotiate politically and do it that way if they can. But they don't think that we're going to be willing to leave and let them have their country. So they're talking about basically raising an army with their Shia brothers from other districts.
Prepared to fight the Sunni and prepared, if necessary, to fight the Americans or the British. Morgan, thanks for your call. Stephen Metz, what do you hear in that? I mean, clearly there are deep ethnic and divisions in Iraq, tribal divisions in Iraq. What does that mean for the effort to bring stability, to bring order, to bring an exit path for the U.S. here?
Absolutely vital point, really, in two different ways. First of all, most people who have looked at the insurgency in Iraq believe that so long as it remains essentially a Sunni insurgency, that it's controllable. But the sign of true danger would be if somehow it would spread to the Shia regions. In other words, if the Shias would run out of patience with the American occupation, and if they too would join the insurgency. At that point, it would be very, very difficult, maybe even impossible for the Americans to control.
In the last few days, we've heard the Ayatollah Sistani, the Shiite leader, saying not only does he want more direct elections before this handover of power in June, or to follow that handover, I guess before it, he also wants a say on whether or not U.S. forces stay or go. I mean, we're talking here as though U.S. forces can just assume they'll be there for years if necessary. Is that in the political cards, Stephen Metz?
Hard to predict at this point. I mean, it really depends on the composition and the will of the new government. I mean, Americans are saying that we feel that it's necessary for the stability of the nation for us to be there for several years. You know, that's what we would like to see. There is, I guess, at least the possibility that once the new government stands up, if they say we don't want you here, if they are a legitimate government, there's not a lot we could do about that. But let me just briefly address the other element of this, the arming of the Shia.
Yes.
That's I think another reason, though, for a continued presence of the Americans there until there is, in fact, a legitimate stable government there. Because if we leave too hastily, then, in fact, what the nation is going to do is to degenerate into civil war, which could inflame the entire region.
Larry's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
In Vietnam, insurgent sanctuary outside the South was thought to play an important role in the war. To what degree is sanctuary from Syria significant in the Iraq insurgency, and has Nagel discussed any strategy for addressing this if this is an issue?
Larry, thanks for the call. Let us pick that up. Peter Moss, have you looked at that at all? John Nagel's pretty focused right there on the Sunni triangle, but what about at the borders? How big a factor? We just heard our caller describing, as he saw it, truckloads of people coming in from Iran. I don't know about that, but maybe so. There have been reports of people coming in from Syria and Saudi Arabia. How important is the outside of Iraq factor in determining what goes on inside Iraq?
It's very important, but there are kind of two angles to it, really, in terms of Syria and sanctuary and Iran and sanctuary, for that matter. One is the issue of sanctuary, you know, fighters kind of going over to Syria when things get too hot and taking a break and a break over there, or going to Jordan, for that matter. And then the other one, of course, is foreign fighters infiltrating into Iraq and participating in the insurgency there. There's really not a great amount of evidence of a large or significant number of foreign fighters being in the ranks of the insurgency. It's not to say there aren't any. There are. And their role, in fact, could be particularly useful or have been played out in some of these suicide bombings, because it tends to be religious extremists who do those things. And there aren't really a huge number of religious extremists among Iraqis, more so amongst the ranks of foreign al-Qaeda-type fighters. But in terms of, you know, foreigners coming inside and all that, I mean, there are generally two types of people in Iraq these days, those who are arming themselves and those who are already armed. And it's not so much, I don't think, a problem of you know, the Shias someday deciding to take up arms against the Americans. I think the real issue is them taking up arms against each other, them taking up arms against the Sunnis taking up arms against the Kurds. Civil war is perhaps the next stage, something that the insurgency could morph into if they don't go well.
That is not a pretty picture. But Stephen Metz, what about the idea of sanctuary outside Iraq's borders? Do you expect that could evolve into a factor in this conflict?
I really don't think so, not in the Vietnam sense, simply because all of the other nations of the region have too much respect for American power and American willpower at this point to do that. But what I think is the most important foreign component of the whole thing is the influx of money at this point, because so long as the remaining Baathists have piles of money, they can hire people to undertake insurgent raids. And, you know, there does seem to be some influx of money from various sources. So I really think that's the most important dimension of outside support. And that could literally be coming from anywhere around the globe.
Peter Moss, you end up your piece looking at John Nagel with the observation that essentially at this point, at least at the moment that you wrote, the United States should be seen as underdogs in this conflict. The superpower is an underdog in this standoff?
Well, I'd be interested to hear what Stephen has to say about this, because I think he's got more of an academic mind and has studied this even more in depth than I have. But if you look at the historical record of counterinsurgencies, it's not a terribly bright picture. I mean, even the British example in Malaya, which is universally kind of pointed to as an example of a successful insurgency, in the end, the reason why it completely went away was because Malaya got its independence. The Philippine War at the turn of the century is also regarded as a successful counterinsurgency effort. That required the deaths of 4,000 American soldiers, 20,000 insurgents at least.
Some numbers much higher.
Exactly, and some numbers as high as several hundred thousand civilians who died of diseases and things associated with the war. And these are successes. El Salvador in some circles is also regarded as a success, but of course we know the human cost in terms of human rights violations and something on the order of 50,000 innocent civilians
pretty
who were
terrible
killed.
Toll.
So just on the basis of that, it's not a pretty picture. Of course, the lessons have been learned, but there's a real problem of applying the lessons of history. I mean, you can know what to do, but maybe you don't have the resources to do it, or maybe even with the resources, the task that you're trying to accomplish is perhaps nearly impossible to accomplish. And that's why if America pulls off a successful counterinsurgency effort here, and it very well could, in a short, relatively bloodless fashion, this will be probably the greatest triumph of counterinsurgency of all time.
You say that a successful counterinsurgency that does not drag on for years and does not involve a large amount of killing has never been achieved by any army. Steve Metz, the United States is underdog in this confrontation?
Well, I'm not sure I would agree with that. To tell you the truth, I've never done a count, but on the other hand, I think if we went back in history, we'd find that there's been dozens, probably hundreds of insurgencies that petered out fairly quickly. The reason that they don't pop to our minds is because those aren't the ones that made the history books. I mean, the ones that made the history books that popped to our minds are the ones that dragged on and in some cases were successful. My read on this one is so long as it remains restrained and constrained to the Sunni triangle, and so long as the U.S. remains dedicated to a relatively rapid handover to an Iraqi administration, I'm fairly confident that there'll be a successful outcome. If it spreads to the Shia regions, or if the U.S. loses its will, if this becomes an element in the upcoming American political election.
Well, it is an element in that election.
Well, if it comes down to the Democrats being a post-American involvement, a continued American involvement in Iraq, and the Republicans in favor of it, if it unfolds that way, then, in fact, we could be heading toward failure there.
Well, some big ifs. But, Peter Maas, as you conclude, you find John Nagel up against it. Not an easy path, messy, slow, bloody, long, but still at this point trusting that it will eventually work out.
Yeah, but we'll have to see. And he's smart enough to know that you can't predict the future course and outcomes of wars.
And that it's going to take some luck, in his words, as you report them, for it to happen. And there's some big ifs that Stephen Metz is talking about here. Stephen Metz at the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute, thank you for being with us tonight.
Sure, my pleasure.
And Peter Maas, thanks for a terrific piece, and thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Peter Maas, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, an Army War College report criticizes the war on terrorism. This is On Point. A new report published by the Army War College is criticizing the Bush administration's war on terrorism as being unfocused and riddled with errors. Among those errors, it says, was the invasion of Iraq itself. The report, titled Bounding the Global War on Terrorism, was written by Jeffrey Record, a professor at the Air War College at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama. A Defense Department spokesman decried the report, saying, quote, any study that concludes we should not aggressively pursue the global war on terror would be irresponsible. But the study has been a hot topic in Washington and in Iowa this week. Here is an excerpt from the report read by WBUR's Sean Cole.
In the wake of the September 11, 2001 al-Qaeda terrorist attacks in the United States, the U.S. government declared a global war on terrorism. The nature and parameters of that war, however, remain frustratingly unclear. The administration has postulated a multiplicity of enemies, including rogue states, weapons of mass destruction proliferators, terrorist organizations of global, regional, and national scope, and terrorism itself. It also seems to have conflated them into a monolithic threat, and in so doing has subordinated strategic clarity to the moral clarity it strives for in foreign policy, and may have set the United States on a course of open-ended and gratuitous conflict with states and non-state entities that pose no serious threat to the United States. Of particular concern has been the conflation of al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's Iraq as a single, undifferentiated terrorist threat. This was a strategic error of the first order because it ignored critical differences between the two in character, threat level, and susceptibility to U.S. deterrence and military action. The result has been an unnecessary preventive war of choice against a deterred Iraq that has created a new front in the Middle East for Islamic terrorism and diverted attention and resources away from securing the American homeland against further assault by an undeterrable al-Qaeda. The war against Iraq was not integral to the global war on terrorism, but rather a detour from it. Additionally, most of the global war on terrorism's declared objectives, which include the destruction of al-Qaeda and other transnational terrorist organizations, the transformation of Iraq into a prosperous, stable democracy, the democratization of the rest of the autocratic Middle East, the eradication of terrorism as a means of irregular warfare, and the forcible, if necessary, termination of weapons of mass destruction proliferation to real and potential enemies worldwide, are unrealistic and condemn the United States to a hopeless quest for absolute security. As such, the global war on terrorism's goals are also politically, fiscally, and militarily unsustainable.
An excerpt from a paper published by the Army War College's Strategic Studies Institute. The excerpt was read by WBUR's Sean Cole. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.